This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, May 2, 2003. From WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandes. From Navy combat plane to US warship, a highly choreographed presidential address to the nation to declare victory in Iraq. Iraqis are organizing to bring stability, but the devastation to their land has left them with little resources to rebuild. And a worldwide hunger strike is launched to win justice for the victims of the world's worst industrial disaster in Bhopal, India. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. At least 7 people were killed and several badly burned when a fuel tanker exploded in central Baghdad. Iris Mackler was there.
Hundreds gathered as an explosion wrecked the city center. A gas tanker at a depot across from the looted Baghdad Museum went up in flames. Thick black smoke enveloped the area, blocking out the sun. The cause has not yet been confirmed. The sound of gunfire turned the mood ugly. Tanks rolled in to push back the crowd. With hundreds shouting anti-American slogans, ending in English with "No, no, Bush." Though the chaos following the blaze didn't result in civilian deaths, it comes during a week when demonstrators have been killed by American troops in 2 incidents in the town of Fallujah. On the day after American President George Bush declared the war over, American soldiers were engaged in a battle just to maintain order on the streets of Baghdad.
That was Iris Mackler reporting from Baghdad. Democratic Congressman Henry Waxman is calling for Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to investigate Halliburton. He questions the legality of the oil giant's business dealings with Iran, Iraq, and Libya. With more from Washington, D.C., Jessica Mikasa.
Congressman Waxman says that Halliburton, formerly run by Vice President Dick Cheney, has subsidiaries and joint ventures that continually conducted business with Iran, Iraq, and Libya despite the U.S.-led sanctions. Halliburton, one of several companies now vying for lucrative contracts for the reconstruction of Iraq, gained great attention recently when one of its subsidiary companies was hired to extinguish Iraqi oil well fires. Halliburton's business history with countries known to sponsor terrorism has raised the concerns of many critics. Lee Drutman of Citizen Works.
One of the companies that is helping to supposedly fight the war on terror is a company that has conducted business with state sponsors of terrorism. I think that undermines our effort.
Though Halliburton believes its subsidiaries to be in compliance with U.S. laws, they admit that they do not always agree with nor excuse the policies or actions of the governments where their business is conducted. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Jessica Mikasa.
The president's candidate for Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs had his first confirmation hearing this week. Some in Washington say Roger Noriega would further strain the White House's relations with Latin America. Laura Doggett reports from D.C.
The war against terrorism has shifted the Bush administration's focus away from Latin America, and most of its countries refuse to support the U.S.-led war on Iraq. Many leaders in the region were happy to see right-wing Cuban-American Otto Reich's term run out. Last year, President Bush appointed him to the post during the congressional recess. Now Congress is considering Bush nominee Roger Francisco Noriega, who was an aide to former Senator Jesse Helms before taking his current position as ambassador to the Organization of the American States. Larry Burns of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs says Noriega is an inappropriate candidate.
You could staff an effective conservative operation by getting perfectly credible people of a conservative persuasion, but they are professionals. Noriega is not a professional.
The administration's policy on Cuba and its delay in signing the free trade agreement with Chile were among the concerns that Noriega addressed at yesterday's hearing. If he is appointed, Noriega will become the Bush administration's first confirmed Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. Laura Doggett in D.C. for Free Speech Radio News.
An appeals judge in British Columbia handed down a decision that paves the way for same-sex marriage in Canada. Greg Younger Lewis reports.
Gay and lesbian couples embraced each other outside a courtroom in Vancouver yesterday. A judge from the British Columbia Court of Appeal told the couples that gay and lesbians will have the right to marry by next year unless the Canadian government files a Supreme Court challenge. Lawyers representing the gay and lesbian couples say the Canadian government has no choice but to accept the decision. The Canadian government has yet to comment on the case, but is already challenging two similar cases in other provinces. If Canada fails to block same-sex marriages, gays and lesbians say the decision will have a ripple effect across North America. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Greg Younger-Lewis in Ottawa.
The U.S. unemployment rate jumped to a four-month high of 6% in April, and firms cut jobs for the third straight month in a row. The Labor Department says the jobless rate climbed 0.2 percentage points since March. Hours worked were cut back sharply to 34 hours in April. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
As Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld announced yesterday that U.S.-led forces in Afghanistan had moved from major combat operations to, quote, a period of stability and reconstruction, President Bush last night declared the end of major combat in Iraq in a highly choreographed presidential address to the nation. Nigel Middleton has this report.
The Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror that began on September the 11th, 2001, and still goes on.
President George Bush addressing the nation from the USS Abraham Lincoln, an aircraft carrier that was instrumental in the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. The commander-in-chief made what most media described as a dramatic entrance. He co-piloted a Navy combat plane making a tailhook landing on the ship moments before emerging in full military gear to greet soldiers on deck. Thousands of Marines, soldiers, and pilots, about to be reunited with their families, surrounded the president as he made a 25-minute speech. A banner hanging behind the president read, "Mission accomplished."
I think you could call it the father of all photo ops.
Norman Solomon, executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and co-author of Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You.
I think if we hadn't been so culturally and politically conditioned to accept this sort of spectacle, it would seem remarkably bellicose and militaristic. But we have become accustomed as Americans to this sort of show of military bravado and, some would say, bloodthirsty effort to celebrate the taking of lives for a foreign policy that is built on deception.
Bush asserted that victory over Saddam Hussein had meant the removal of an ally of al-Qaeda. He also evoked the, quote, patient justice of the United States. In the midst of numerous repetitions of the words freedom and liberty, Bush talked about the liberation, not the occupation, of Iraq. White House spokesperson Ari Fleischer had forewarned that Bush's speech was not to be read as the, quote, legal end to hostilities, which leaves many analysts puzzled.
This would certainly qualify in legal terms as a declaration for the end of war, which would trigger the obligations under the Third Geneva Convention to set free all Iraqi prisoners of war, which the Bush administration has indicated they are not prepared to do.
Francis Boyle, professor of international law at the University of Illinois.
It also means then that now technically and legally the United States government becomes the belligerent occupant of Iraq under the international laws of belligerent occupation. So far the Pentagon has refused to use that language, and even when UN Secretary General Kofi Annan did, they attacked him.
Bush never once mentioned the United Nations in his speech, nor did he mention allies that have come out in opposition to the American doctrine of preemptive war. Instead, he praised Britain, Australia, and Poland, and signaled his determination to further apply the new doctrine.
Our government has taken unprecedented measures to defend the homeland, and we will continue to hunt down the enemy before he can strike.
Bush also warned, quote, outlaw regimes, and many analysts believe he had at least Iran in mind, that sponsor terrorism and seek weapons of mass destruction. Of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, he said little. Bush asserted that the war against terrorism is not over. The Navy aircraft he arrived in is worth $27 million. The USS Abraham Lincoln, on which he landed, is worth about $4.5 billion. Brad Simpson of the War Resisters League says the Bush administration is putting its money where its mouth is.
For this year alone, the Bush administration plans on spending more than $400 billion for war preparation, and that doesn't include the $80 billion that it secured from Congress to fight the Iraq war. The United States spends more on preparations for war than the rest of the world put together, and still insists that it must continually prepare for and wage war in order to maintain its global dominance.
Meanwhile, in what many believe is an attempt to counterbalance American hegemony, France, Germany, Luxembourg, and Belgium are hoping to boost European military spending. Chris Lindberg of the British American Security Information Council says the timing of their proposals has made many suspicious of their intentions.
They have plans or setting out an agenda to create by the summer of 2004 a military planning center based just outside of Brussels, which would be independent of NATO planning. And this is of particular concern to people who want the current transatlantic security architecture to remain highly interdependent.
Lindberg says that although the European community is divided on defense along the same lines it was over Iraq, member countries will strive to present a united front at the summit that just started today in Greece. Meanwhile, amid international pressure, the Bush administration will replace retired General Jay Garner with Paul Bremer as the top U.S. civilian official in post-war Iraq. We'll have more on Paul Bremer next week. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nadja Middleton.
UNICEF said today that thousands of Iraqi children will die unless they are made a top priority in the chaotic post-war situation. This is international aid agencies today appealed for the UN to be given a key role in rebuilding Iraq. Oxfam, Islamic Relief and Caritas, among others, issued a statement today saying the UN must play a role in doing what the US and British have so far failed to do, stop the spread of disease and hunger across the country. And as Aaron Glantz reports from Fallujah, Iraq, while Iraqis are organizing to bring stability, the devastation to their land has left them with little resources to rebuild.
It's Friday, the Muslim holy day in Fallujah, a mid-sized Sunni-majority city an hour's drive west of Baghdad. American troops killed 14 Iraqis here during celebrations to mark Saddam Hussein's birthday on Monday, and they killed another two people here on Wednesday. About 1,000 people turned out for the funerals on Thursday, and many expected more blood today, since Muslims often take to the streets in protest after Friday prayers. But there were no protests in Fallujah today. The imams of Fallujah have been meeting behind closed doors with the American authorities, and today they preached a message of tolerance of the American presence. Imam Shakir speaks to a crowd of hundreds inside the city's Al-Kabir Mosque. He tells his congregation America has perpetrated an aggression against the people of Iraq, and especially the people of Fallujah. And he says the United States is guilty of crimes against humanity. He says the American army should leave Fallujah. But he also calls on the people of Fallujah to be reasonable. He tells them Islam is a religion of peace, that they should not confront the Americans and should not turn out to protest. Still, prayer isn't the only sound floating through the air of Fallujah today. There are at least two makeshift gun markets in Fallujah selling everything from Kalashnikovs to World War II-era British and Russian machine guns. No one asks where the guns came from suddenly. Like the rest of Iraq, there has been a complete breakdown in the civil infrastructure here. There are no police on the street, and so many Iraqis are moving to buy guns. And the security situation isn't the only part of the infrastructure that's in a state of collapse. All the schools in Fallujah are closed. Khatem owns a convenience store.
Nothing. Nothing. No money, no water, no just no gas, no machine, no anything. No gas, no machine, no anything.
But around the weapons market, there's a state of normalcy. The kebab restaurant next to a 10-year-old boy testing a Kalashnikov is full. And the main marketplace, hundreds of chickens are for sale amongst the fruit and vegetable stalls. There is an American military presence, to be sure. The U.S. Army has taken over one of the city's main schools and guarded it with tanks and snipers and surrounded it with barbed wire. Every so often, a tank rolls through the middle of town. The locals have no idea when they'll leave. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Fallujah, Iraq.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandes. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. Yesterday, survivors of the world's worst industrial tragedy from Bhopal, India, launched a worldwide relay hunger strike from New York to expose the falsehoods they say Dow Chemical propagates. In June 2002, the relay hunger strike for justice in Bhopal went on for nearly 2 months, with more than 1,500 people joining worldwide. The disaster occurred some 19 years ago, and since then the victims say they've received nothing, compensation nor justice. And as Binu Alex reports from the disaster site in Bhopal, what victims have instead received is a legal notice from Dow Chemical suing the victims for thousands of dollars.
Not far away from the railway station in Bhopal, thousands of victims who inhaled poisonous gas 2 decades back live in worse living conditions. Many of them are on protest.
We have gone to jail for justice and no one can threaten us.
This is Kailash Sharma, who got a legal notice from Dow Chemicals, the buyer of Union Carbide, which caused the worst ever industrial disaster in history.
As long as we live, we have no fear and we will pass this on to our children.
Her crime, she says, is that she joined some 200 women to protest against Dow Chemicals in their Bombay headquarters last month. All of them are charged with a total of $10,000 for loss of work fee. This loss of pay, says Dow, is as a result of one senior employee of the company having to listen to victims from the Bhopal accident site. This accident site has never been cleaned up and continues to leak mercury and other chemicals into the groundwater. Champa Devi Shukla is one of the protesters who got the legal notice.
Bhopal residents should get medical treatment and compensation. The environment should be cleaned and gas victims should be settled. Until this is fulfilled by Dow, we will not turn back from our protests.
The survivors asked the patient employee why Dow, which settled Union Carbide's liabilities in the U.S., refuses to settle its liabilities in India. But these protests and movements have not made any difference to the victims, as government and the corporate world continues to neglect them. Casualty figures of more than 16,000 are still a matter of dispute, whereas the number of permanently disabled, those born deformed, climbed to tens of thousands. These are the victims who take to streets to get justice, and one of them is Rashida B.
Bhopal is alive today because of our fight. Otherwise, it would have been a memory. Our government is supporting the company to end the fight by terror. But they hardly know these women are already dead victims. You cannot threaten a corpse.
Activists like Satinath Saranki, associated with the victims since the disaster on a cold December night, believes that the survivors have no other option.
Terrorizing people by using the law. They've done it twice. In the first instance, when there was a demonstration in February 2001, then they sued asking for money to be paid for the additional security that the company has had to provide during the time of the demonstration. What I know for sure, that the people in the survivors in Bhopal, had they not fought as they did right from first month, they would not have got anything. They would not have got even medical relief or whatever little they got. So here it is not it's not like a choice whether you fight or not. It's if you have to survive, you have to fight.
And the fight continues in various forms at various places across the globe. Geographically, the disaster may be limited to Bhopal, but sentimentally it has drawn global attraction. From Bhopal in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
For the second time in 2 weeks, the Lacandon Indians have led an incursion backed by the Mexican military and two federal environmental agencies into Zapatista support base communities situated within the ever-tense Montes Azules Nature Reserve in Chiapas. The latest incursion has spurred the state government to solicit the intervention of the independent Fray Bartolomé de las Casas Human Rights Center in hopes of defusing the explosive situation. The Human Rights Center will announce its decision sometime today. Tim Russo brings us the latest from southern Mexico.
Such is the threat of provoked violence in the Montes Azules Ecological Reserve in the depths of the Lacandon jungle that the COCOPA, the Congressional Intermediary Team for Peace Negotiations between the Mexican government and the ragtag Zapatista National Liberation Army, announced early this week an unexpected trip to Chiapas on May 2nd. Antonio Salgado, a collaborating researcher with the Interdisciplinary Research Program for Human Development in Chiapas, commented on the recent announcement by the all-but-dormant COCOPA.
In fact, the COCOPA has no actual presence or connection with the communities in the reserve. The fact that they are coming now is about prestige in the moment and to get involved in a game without having a position or the capacity to get close to anyone. The state government is actually searching for intermediaries to talk to the communities, but they are not presenting any proposals to resolve the fundamental problems. There are no proposals about the paramilitaries. The Lacandonis that are participating in this are functioning with armed groups, with the military and marines in the same way that the paramilitaries in the northern zone began to function in 1995.
Recognizing the belligerent attitude of the Lacandon community while evading the responsibility and involvement of his own organization, Hernan Alonso León, the director of the Attorney General's Federal Environmental Protection Agency, PROFEPA, described the potential for escalation.
The measure is to request the Lacandon community to not act on this. If they ignore this, then there will have to be a forceful intervention. The state authorities and the police will have to cordon off the zone with the elements from the state police in order to protect the integrity of everyone.
Mr. Salgado described what he saw in San Isidro and Nuevo San Rafael this weekend when the Lacandon Indians once again threatened to forcibly displace these Zapatista support-based villages.
The representative of the Lacandon community got upset and said that if the government did not resolve the problems, then the community was not going to walk around the problem like the government, but rather would make a decision and resolve this directly. He said that they were the owners of the jungle and that they would do whatever their assembly decided. So they went there, accompanied by the military in order to pressure a forced displacement. They leave few options for a village that came here displaced and threatened by paramilitaries.
While criticizing the actions of the Lacandones, Mr. Hernan León also explained their role as de facto inspectors for PROFEPA.
The PROFEPA inspectors, with the support of the military, visited the villages to make a judicial note and present a denunciation to the public minister. We are establishing that in accordance with the federal penal code, they are violating the sanctions against the use and clearing of forested lands without authorization. We have solicited the support of the courts so that they will issue apprehension orders against these villages.
A representative from San Isidro described the recent incursions.
So they will come first so that we leave. The next time they come, if we haven't left yet, they will forcibly displace us, kill us straight away. That's what the Lacandones told us.
An international observer on the scene over the weekend further explained interests at play in the region where the communities are being threatened.
There's economic interest in that region. In Chajul, they have just discovered new ruins, and that there's been gringos around asking about, you know, excavating and starting tourism. So in Ixcan, they're all priistas, and the government gives them aid but has set a new condition that they won't give them aid unless they cut between 8 and 20 hectares a year on the side of where Nuevo San Rafael is. So the plan, of course, is like deforest, blame it on the compañeros that are there.
Her explanations coincide with the actual justifications used against the community. alleging that they are destroying the rainforest. In the meantime, Nuevo San Rafael and San Isidro have been given their second warning and 20 days to abandon their villages. Human rights groups will decide this Friday if they will mediate the situation while finishing last-minute details leading up to the highly anticipated May 6th through 10th First Hemispheric Forum Against Militarization being held in San Cristóbal de las Casas. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Tim Russo.
And today Australia's Prime Minister met with President Bush at his Texas ranch. John Howard is the first foreign head of state to visit the Texas White House since the Crawford Peace House opened its doors. And in Austin, Texas, people are gearing up for a showdown. Stephen Ray has more.
Australian Prime Minister John Howard began a two-day meeting today with President Bush in Crawford, Texas. Post-war reconstruction of Iraq is one of the items slated for discussion. 1 year ago, British Prime Minister Tony Blair visited the Bush Ranch. So have the leaders of China and Spain. When Blair came, the Dallas Peace Center organized a rally about Palestine and Iraq that drew more than 1,000 people. This year, peace activists purchased a house right in the center of town and have created a Crawford Peace House. All spring, volunteers from North Texas have spent weekends busy refurbishing the house and creating gardens and a labyrinth outside. Howard is the first foreign leader to visit the small Texas town since the Crawford Peace House opened its doors. Michelle Sandlin from Dallas explains the vision for this new space.
We're here to create an opening for the community and to serve the community that we're in. We're also here because we want to establish an interfaith peace center, an interfaith worship center, an independent media center. We want a place that will serve as an alternative to regular media coverage.
Much of the inspiration and vision for the Crawford Peace House comes from John Wolfe, also from Dallas.
We wanted to give a gift to the people of Crawford and people that come down here to see the president. We wanted to be able to have a beautiful garden to give those people as a gift. Because of the garden, the neighbors have complimented us. The funniest thing, last weekend the postman came by, honked his horn and waved us over and said, "I'm so glad you're here, I don't feel alone."
Kay Lucas from the town of Moody, just south of Crawford, helped plan the garden.
Everybody's pitched in a different idea and a different version and brought plants, and it's just been a community working together, and that's what life ought to be.
Larry McClung, a volunteer from the Dallas area, says the Crawford Peace House has already gained international attention.
I have met people from the Netherlands, from Germany. There were Swiss media people here one day. It's just amazing that people have heard about this already.
Meanwhile, on Saturday, people from around the country will converge on Austin, the state capital, for a showdown in Texas. The showdown is a multi-issue march and rally against the Bush agenda of war, militarism, and hate, say organizers. Feeder marches from 6 starting points will reach the state capital for a rally at high noon. One of the showdown's demands is for true human security, which would mean housing, health care, education, jobs, and respect for the civil rights of all. After the rally, a car caravan will leave Austin for Crawford to take the showdown's message to the president. This is Stefan Ray in Crawford, Texas.
Free Speech Radio News is produced by Cutta Mesta at the studios of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston. Headline editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram at WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Technical producers are Jade Paget-Seekins and Pauline Bartolone at Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley. Josh Chaffin is our DC editor at Pacifica Station WPFW. Web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. You can visit FSRN online at www.fsrn.org. I'm Deepa Fernandez.